It's a smile test. I'll just see who I can get to reciprocate. That means reply. In like manner. Because we're meant to be a reciprocity community. Did you know that? Because that's one of the definitions of fellowship. What we share in common together. The shared life. And I'm just going to get those bits and pieces out that you need these days to be able to preach a sermon. The pictures of the PowerPoint, so I know what's going to come next. You've seen it now, haven't you? And I did have a clipper here, that's right, yes, yeah. Looking at this series, we've been thinking about keeping company with Jesus, and we've been using our bodies to think about that. Looking at him in wonder, awe, and worship. Looking at that passage in, I think, 2 Corinthians 3, whereby as we look at God, we become what we look at most clearly. We become transformed by that picture and that vision of him. We look at him in our eyes of faith. And then also last week we were looking at opening your heart through prayer. It's natural, isn't it, when we meet with that God in the face of Jesus Christ. We want to spend time with him, want to hear his voice speaking to us, and want to have our hearts moved and our wills particularly transformed by that experience of keeping company with him. That is the purpose of prayer, isn't it? To tell God what we need to do. And it isn't primarily for him to tell us what he wants us to do. It's for us to be our hearts and wills changed by who he is and that encounter. And thinking about now, open your heart, open your life in fellowship. There's two more to come. Open your hands in service. Natural, isn't it, that when we learn how to respond to this living and loving God, that we will be able to share effectively with others. So, this is the one that's highlighted, the one in bold. Open your heart in fellowship. We're going to meet with the congregation of the penguins today. And there they are. They must be Pentecostal penguins because they're looking up to heaven. And they're having a really good time by the looks of it. Opening your heart in fellowship. Good definition of fellowship is simply sharing what we have in common. I think it was preacher David Pawson who went to one of these Christian events. And afterwards, they had fellowship together, so they said, and they had sandwiches together, you know. Now, I love Christian events with sandwiches. I see it as a bit of a dare, you know. I try the egg sandwiches to see if I'm still with us this 3 days later. But you can't always be sure, can you, with the egg sandwiches? Anyway, he did the right thing. He took a plate of egg sandwiches away with him. He sat down next to this lady and somebody on the other side was chatting with him. Being the pastor of the church, he was distracted, talking to somebody on his left. And when he came back to his sandwich, which he'd not touched before, he found one of the pieces had a bite missing. And then the gentleman across the table wanted a word with him as well, so he had a few words with him, and he came back and found that bite was bigger and the sandwich was missing. And he soon discovered the culprit was on his right-hand side, a lady who didn't have a plate, and what were they doing? They were sharing what they had in common. It so happens to be his plate. Now, when we use the word communion, which we think about the breaking of bread service here, that word is strictly linked to what we have in common. In fact, who we have in common, isn't it? We're celebrating the life together centred upon the one in whom we have in common, the person of Jesus Christ. Now, there's a verse in the Bible that preachers often talk about being together and meeting together, which I want us just to think about for a few minutes, just to kind of, as it were, park this sentence and get it, as it were, dealt with. And it's Hebrews 10:25. And it's a very important passage in the Bible. It says, let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, and all the more as we see the day approaching. Now, I've heard preachers really go to town on this verse and get very, very vexed about the people who are not meeting together. And they berate the congregation quite strongly about the neglect of meeting together. Now, I sometimes think when I'm sat in the congregation listening to that kind of preaching and that kind of person speaking like this, I think it's a bit foolish in some ways. And also it misses a point, which we often do with verses of the Bible that are rarely precious to us. It's a bit foolish because I'm sat there thinking, well, I'm meeting together. I'm here. I've actually turned up. And when I think of the older version where it says, do not neglect to assemble together, I think to myself, am I not assembled? And I look to the person on my right and say, are you disassembled? Are you not? It seems a bit stupid, doesn't it, to harass the people who are already there? Because we need to kind of remind the people who are not here. That is a point of the verse. But the second thing that makes me worry about the use of this verse when everybody's gathered together, because it not only harasses the ones who are there, it can make the ones who are there sometimes feel a bit smug. You know, looking around and saying, well, I've assembled. Where's Mrs. Jones? I haven't seen her for weeks. And then misses the very point of the passage itself, which is a point of being together, sharing what we have, is to encourage each other. That is the whole section of that passage in Hebrews. The time of distress and suffering is great. The writer says we should encourage each other. And all the more as we see the great day of Jesus coming, and that is encouraging, that what we're going through now is nothing compared to the glory that we will receive when he returns. And that's what Paul says. Encouraging. Being lifted up by that. So the business of being together as a people of God is about the business of encouraging each other. And the fact of the matter is, I need who?
Jesus.
I need, well, it's a very old poster. Many of you won't know where it's from. It's a First World War poster of Lord Kitchener, who recruited many people to fight in the First World War, and he had his pointy finger saying, Britain needs you. Well, today, I'm here to say, I need you. Some of you look as if you know who that poster was about, and a lot of you look completely nonplussed. But I need you, and we need each other. Why do I need you? I need you for the business of support and company in the journey of life with God. And that was the purpose of that wonderful reading from Isaiah 35. Isaiah had seen the future of the people of God. They were banged up in Babylon, away from their home, but he knew that there would come a day when they would be coming and returning back home. But that was a journey of some thousands of miles. But they wouldn't do it alone. They would do it together. And they would know that as they were travelling together, sometimes there would be people who would be weak and frail and get tired and get discouraged along the way. So he says in verse 3, strengthen the feeble knees, steady the hands. To those who are fearful in heart, say, be strong, do not fear, for your God will come. That is a business of encouragement. That is a business of exhorting. That is a business of pulling people verbally and sometimes physically along in the journey and supporting as we go. What is he saying? Be strong and do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with justice and with divine retribution. He will come to save you. We will get there. We will do it. We will continue on. And that's why we need each other. Why I need you for encouragement in the journey. Because the Christian life isn't one single event of new birth, completed by another single event of return when Jesus comes. It's a journey of a life lived together, together with him. I need you for the journey. I need you to pick me up when I fall. That's quite literally true sometimes, right? But it's morally and spiritually true also. The Apostle Paul says these words, "Brothers, if someone is caught in sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. Watch for yourself, or you also may be tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions." And that's from the letter of Galatians. And Paul was saying, after a wonderful section in chapter 5, have you ever noticed how Bible passages do follow each other? You know, chapter 6 follows chapter 5. And then one of the wonderful things about chapter 6, it talks about the Spirit-filled life. And lots of Christians enjoy that chapter 5, the fruit of the Spirit of love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. The life of Jesus that we desire to be lived in and through us. And they often stop there. What is the point of that Spirit-filled life, says Paul? The point of the Spirit-filled life is chapter 6, verse 1. It's being sensitive in how we deal with each other when we stumble. Because we can be very, very harsh and judgmental sometimes. And he's saying, if you're a Spirit-filled person, a person who is connected to God, who allows God to work in your life by his Son, by his Spirit, you'll know how to deal gently with people when they stumble. You won't be harsh with them because you know that you too have weaknesses in different areas of your life, maybe. But you'll know how to lift the fallen because you too are beset with other weaknesses. And be careful, he says, because in your pride at helping other people, you might become succumb to temptations of your own. So I need you for the journey. I need you to pick me up when I stray and draw me back into the life of Jesus. I need also you, and this is in Galatians as well, to challenge my sense of self-righteousness or my sense of hypocrisy. I have a good friend who likes to tease me about my sense of self-respect. It goes like this. We have Bible studies together, myself and a couple of blokes in Coventry, and at the end of it, one of them said, would you give me a lift to my doctor's to pick up a prescription, you see? And so I thought, oh, that's fair enough, that's easily done, isn't it? You know, be a useful Christian. Be kind to everybody. I'd do even the same for a friend. So as we're going downstairs out of the flat, somebody approaches this guy and says, where are you going? He says, oh, we're going to get some drugs. And I said, no, we're not. No, there was quite a nice surprised look on the person's face as I said that, as if they were keen to know where they were going to get them from. And I said, no, we're not. We're going to a chemist. How depressed that person looked. And when I got into the car, my friend said to me, you were worried about your respectability there, weren't you, Doug, eh? Our respectability can lead us to some real problems. And that was true for dear Peter, wasn't it? Paul had to challenge Peter very strongly, because something was happening to Peter that when he met with good Gentile Christians who were not knowing the Jewish way of life, he was happy to meet with them as a good Jew Christian. But when some Jewish believers came with their laws and their rules about fasting, about Sabbath, and about being done doing the right things, Peter would just ignore the Gentile ones, woof, and just sit and have meals with the good Jewish ones. Paul said, when I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the good news, I said to Peter, in front of them all, you are a Jew, and yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? We who are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners know that a man is not justified by observing the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. So we have put our faith in Christ Jesus, that we may be justified or accepted by faith in Christ and not observing the law. Because by observing the law, no one shall be accepted. And this is a challenge, isn't it? How to live a good life without being worried about our respectability, about being worried about what other people think about us. Well, God couldn't care less. And that worry can make us care too much. And we can often do the right thing, but end up doing the wrong thing. This idea that we obey rules and observe rules for the right or the wrong reasons. There's a lady who was a very strict observer of the seventh day, the Sabbath. She wouldn't do any work on the Lord's Day, not anything. You can imagine her shock when she came out of her house and she found her neighbour, who she knew was a believer, mowing the lawn. Mow, mow, mow. Morning, morning, morning. And so she did. She said to him, "It's the Sabbath, you're cutting the grass on the Sabbath, what are you doing?" And he rather sheepishly said, "Well, Jesus picked corn on the Sabbath, didn't he?" And she shot back rather unthinkingly, "Well, he should have known better. Two wrongs don't make a right." We can so easily trip ourselves up, can't we? Easily trip ourselves up. Paul says we need each other, especially when we behave in ways that are not right according to the good news. The good news of Jesus is the good news of liberty, of freedom, from all the past rules that control people, so that we might live in a new way, not by sinfulness, but by the Spirit of God lived in and through each one of us. I need you to support me in the journey. I need you to pick me up when I fall, and I need you to challenge my hypocrisy. There is a passage in the Bible which is one of the few passages which talks about when Jesus would be present. It's in Matthew 18. It says, "There are we am in amongst you." And it's a passage about discipline. It says, when you fall out with Doug, you've got to do something very specific. Right? If I've offended you, it says that you've got to come to me and we'll talk it out. I listen to you. I apologise. And we've saved and met with each other. It's in Matthew 18, and Jesus goes on to say, look, if that doesn't happen and Doug won't listen to you, then you're to go and get to others to chat with him. Now, according to my maths, that should be four people. Or four penguins, but I couldn't find four penguins. There you have it. I thought I'd point that out because I know somebody would be thinking, should be four penguins there. And if he doesn't listen even to the penguins, no, even to these two brothers, you take him and to show him to the congregation. And because of his stubbornness of heart, says Jesus, because of that, you're to treat him as if he doesn't belong to you until he does turn that way back to God. Now, I can imagine the first readers of Matthew's gospel hearing that read, they wouldn't have had it on their laps like we have. They would have heard it read and they would have thought, ah, I've got one for him. It really offended me the other week. Now, if I go through these steps and he doesn't say I'm sorry, then I've got him by the scruff of the neck. But if you read the rest of Matthew chapter 18, there's a story that comes up straight after that, and it's a simple story where Peter goes to Jesus and says, how many times should my brother offend me? Seven times? Or 77 times? Now, the fact that that passage and that story is right next to that discipline passage should have told the first readers the issue. You should never get to the position where you're doing that with each other. Because then he went on to tell a story about the unmerciful servant. Somebody owed somebody an incredible amount of money to his king, and he couldn't pay up. Do you have the money? I don't have the money. No. Do you have the money? I don't have the money. Then I forgive you everything. And out of gratitude and relief from the distress and the pressure of indebtedness to the King of Heaven, all people should just say, it is nothing. It is nothing. It doesn't mean that we don't listen to each other, but it does mean that we don't become judgmental and driven by that sense of my rights over this good news that we have one another. We need each other. But the other thing is, sadly, oh, now I'll just whip through these then. Look at that. I need you to support me. I need you to pick me up. But you also need me. Now, why do you need me? I'm the one behind the first one. You understand that, don't you? Is it to inspire you to greater things? Well, that's probably true, right? You can do it. You can jump into this freezing water. That's what the one that was saying behind it, isn't it? You need me to rub you up the wrong way. You really do. And that is my ministry. It's all of our ministries when we think about it. The wonderful transforming work of irritation. Do you have that gift that irritates people so they learn what patience is? I have it. Tress thinks I have it. Because she thinks my wife is a saint, putting up with me. I have it in writing. I don't know how you put up with him. And she said it in love. Just this morning while I was at the hatch. To test your forbearance, your patience, your love. What is that called? It's called developing Christian character. What is that called? It's becoming like Jesus. It's called a theological term called sanctification. We need each other so much to knock the edges of our horribleness and rub up against each other so that we become like Jesus more and more. You know, unless we have each other, then the Christian life is simply a single experience. In fact, if you don't have another person to share that experience of Christ, then it's an experience, actually, it's largely in your brain, in your head. It's largely imaginary until you meet somebody else in the Christian life. We need each other so that we can suffer the slings of outrageous Christians together and learn how to live that life together. And that's why Jesus gave that illustration to Peter when he said, how many times shall Doug offend me? He said, not seven times, but 70 times seven, and you've got to keep on being merciful. Because that's what the gospel is about. You need me, I need you, we need each other. We need to be better at this Christian living, but we needn't be perfect at it. It's not a council of despair. We said it's a council of encouragement. We need to be better, but not necessarily perfect until Jesus comes. I finished with a story by a gentleman called Tony Campolo, a Christian writer and a sociologist. He's had a great effect on people for some generations now. He has a friend who joined an AIDS support group for families whose their own children had been affected by this terrible disease. And one lady had a very, very negative attitude to the church. She felt the church was judgmental towards her for raising a boy who turned out, in her words, to be gay. She hated the church. I wouldn't have anything to do with them. She said when she was most depressed and most isolated, and most alone in her struggles, particularly with the illness of her son, who was HIV positive, she would go to the coffee place nearby where she lives, and she would sit with an elderly gentleman and she would tell her problems. And what did that gentleman do? He listened and he listened and he listened and he listened for days, for weeks, for months. She said to this friend, "I don't know how I would have survived without him." Why can't the church be like that? Very powerful, isn't it? What she didn't know was that that gentleman, who was elderly, was a retired Christian minister. She didn't know he was a minister or a clergyman. He knew that if he told her that that was the case, then she probably wouldn't have talked to him, given her experience. What she needed was not his history, but his shoulder, his presence, his listening. The fact is, we needn't be perfect for God to use us. And the fact is that others need you as well. And that's a wonderful thing about what Jesus does with the Christian community. He tells it to go and spreads it out in this world. Because the mission of Jesus can't be fulfilled by one person. It must be fulfilled by a group of people. The people of God spread out into our communities, into our neighbourhoods. Do you know, statistically, there's probably one Christian for every 80 non-believers in our society. That's a wonderful statistic. It means that the connection points, at least in 100 groups of 100 people, how many Christians that is in that group of people? Connecting, touching lives, and making a difference. That's why what we share in common is very, very, very important. We need each other. We need not be perfect. But the world needs the church as a salt and light in this world. Let's sing a song together. I think it's called "Brothers, Let Me Be Your Servant. Let Me Be as Christ to You." And